Okay, we're back on tape, and you were talking about being careful with money.
Yeah, I can even say that I was probably cheap in most aspects of my life. My family never had too much money, mm-hmm. and my father was quite strict in limiting our luxuries.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have a stipend after a certain age, and I had to work with that, and then whenever I could, I worked to make some money, but I was always very careful, and that, you know, reflected right into the way I run a lab.
Mm-hmm.
So I always tried to save as much money as I could. I was frugal with spending, tried to get a bargain whenever I could. So, you know, I always had that money, and but the fact that this way is because I'm anxious about not having the money. And, you know, and seeing what happened with that as more senior investigator.
Sure.
And that increased anxiety levels quite a bit. But I also learned that, you know, you cannot let your life be run by that kind of stuff. So just try to forget about it. And
mm-hmm.
usually, that's a good thing about the United States. If you have good ideas and you can do some work, there's quite a lot of opportunities out there
mm-hmm.
for you to find money. And, you know, as you get more experience, in theory, you should be better at getting grants and things like that. So, yeah, I'm trying to spend the money more than thinking about
mm-hmm.
how to make more money. I'm
mm-hmm.
definitely not going to be writing a grant for at least 3 years now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because yours run, you've got quite a bit of time left on almost all of them.
Yeah.
Still. Yeah.
I mean, the oldest one is 1 year old.
Yeah. Well, a couple things about the grant writing process. First of all, it occurred to me last night that you could have been a Pew Latin scholar at some point, because they fund, the Latin scholars are funded for their training, right, with the intention to go back to their countries.
Right. Yeah, I wouldn't qualify for a number of reasons.
Uh-huh.
The first one is that I had to be in Latin America when I applied, at least I had to be doing a PhD in a lab
there.
In the United States,
mm-hmm.
but I had to be committed to go back.
Right.
That
right.
was not my situation.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I heard about Pew, I was already a faculty member.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I didn't have the option.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually a nice experience.
Yeah. Well, except it does commit you to go back,
right.
which I don't know if you knew at the outset whether you wanted to go or stay.
Well, once I decided to get a job here, I was
yeah.
committed to
yeah.
stay.
So when did the Pew, you were in the 95 class, so you were already here a year or so by the time you got your Pew, right? And you were already funded from NIH. So was the Pew important to you?
The Pew was extremely important to me.
Mm-hmm.
Not because of the money.
Mm-hmm.
The money, you know, it's really not that much.
Right.
I think we had, when we had it was 50,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Now they increased significantly, I think. But that's what we had. That always helped, of course, particularly because of the flexible source of funds.
Mm-hmm.
That we always mm-hmm. need those. But the way the Pew helped me was to pairing me with the best people in science.
Mm.
Not only the other scholars, but, you know, during the meetings, the people that would deliver lectures, and just the whole environment
mm-hmm.
was very rich.
Mm-hmm.
And that had a major impact in my career, and, you know,
mm.
for me to set some goals of where I want to go.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know if I'm going to reach those levels, but at least I have those standards.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was very important.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the things that occurs to me, you know, when you have to write, whether it be grants or papers, and we'll get on to paper writing a little bit later, you have to do it in English. And I know from my own experiences of speaking other languages, speaking it and writing it well are two entirely different things. How easy or difficult is it for you to write in English?
Right. Yeah, this is really interesting. Like that more senior colleague I had, he, you know, was very good in talking about his projects and getting people excited. Mm-hmm. But he couldn't write a decent grant. Mm. It's amazing how detached speaking or even being fluent talking about something is from writing.
Yeah.
And I have several, you know, American colleagues that cannot write very well, mm-hmm. even though they know very well their areas and all that. So, for some reason, I think I write better than I speak. And I think the writing is not so much the grammar, but it's the ability of making things simple and clear mm-hmm. and concise. Mm-hmm. And I think that turns on reviewers. Mm-hmm. And also the ability to use, you know, images to illustrate your thoughts. Mm-hmm. And I think early on, I got good training just by working with other postdocs in New York on how to use mm-hmm. computers to do graphics and mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. And how to put text and graphs together. And I think that helped me. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been talking for a while. You already know my limitations in English. But when you write, mm-hmm. it's... spelling is easy to check. Grammar, I'll give to a colleague that's, you know, native English speaker. And it can be corrected. And, you know, am I even... Some mistakes might still be there. Mm-hmm. But I think, from what people tell me, I have the ability to communicate things, you know, in a simple and clear way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I never had a problem with writing. But I also always make an effort to give it to someone to review and correct, and I get lots of corrections. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of people that also think that they write well, so they don't really bother in getting an input from other people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big mistake mm-hmm. because, you know, there are always things that you just don't see. Mm-hmm. So everything I write goes through a number of revisions. Mm-hmm. And even when I feel confident that's great, I know that it's not. And, you know, someone should look mm-hmm. should look at it and correct. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps my mm-hmm. my final product. Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, I found your papers quite readable, which is not always the case.
So. Thanks. And those are quite specific topics.
Yeah. So do you enjoy the writing? Is it something that's
pleasant for you? Yes, I do enjoy. Yeah. And, you know, I learned a lot in New York. Di Mauro was a good writer. Mm-hmm. Eric Schoen was a good writer. With Eric, we used to sit together in front of his computer, and he kind of would write it, but he would engage you in such a way that, you know, that you learn mm-hmm. just by being there. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you would be suggesting words and things, and you feel that you're really participating. He would use your words when you suggested one. But, you know, it was a very efficient way because he was writing, basically, mm-hmm. and you were just there helping. Mm-hmm. I've been considering this technique instead of letting students just write and then you have to rewrite it because it's, you know, it's pretty bad. That's a valid method also, and maybe you can learn more from that. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if you cannot learn more first by just being engaged in the process mm-hmm. with a senior person, mm-hmm. and maybe at that point then you go and write your own. But mm-hmm. you already have the basis, mm-hmm. and you see how a senior person would do it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm trying some new papers I have to write. Maybe I'll use this mm-hmm. this technique mm-hmm. with younger people and mm-hmm. see if it works.
See what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. As long as we're talking about grant writing, I want to finish up this area by talking about, since we have an opportunity to learn from you about Brazil, what is the situation for a scientist in Brazil in terms of funding? Where does the money come from? Is it soft money, hard money? How does it work there?
Right. I have been away from the system for a number of years. mm-hmm. But, you know, from the context and information I have, I can give you a good idea, I think.
Mm-hmm.
If you are in São Paulo, you will not have much problems in terms of getting funds. That's because the state has a law that dedicates a certain percentage of the gross product
mm-hmm.
to this foundation, that's a research foundation, called mm-hmm. FAPESP, Fundação de Amparo à Pesquisa do Estado de São Paulo.
You'll give me that later.
Yes. So, people that do decent research have absolutely no problems in getting money from FAPESP, and they actually help you importing things and getting things fast. So, money I don't think is a big hurdle for good groups there.
Mm-hmm.
What I think it is the critical mass
mm-hmm.
and the pressure you have to produce that's really not there.
The pressure here to produce, you mean?
Well, in Brazil, there's not much pressure.
I see. Okay.
Of course, you can be self-motivated and do it, but there's a tendency, you know, if you produce too much there, people in the university probably is not going to like it too much because
no.
you start to become too good.
You make them look bad.
Right.
Yeah.
So that kind of negative pressure exists there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some universities can deal with it better than others. And there are some centers in São Paulo that are very good.
Mm-hmm.
There are some centers in Rio also, Rio de Janeiro, and also in another state, Minas Gerais. It's also in the southeast. And in the south of Brazil also. But if you go outside São Paulo, things get harder. Because investigators do not have state money, at least not a significant amount. And they have to rely on federal funds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, federal funding in Brazil has seen many ups and downs. Once in a while, they come with a program that infuses a lot of money on the federal funding agent that's called CNPq. But it's always full of bureaucracy, lots of delays between awards and receiving the money. That's the problem is compounded by inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's not so much, but in my time, you know, you get $50,000 in Brazilian money, but they'll take 2 years to give you the money. And, you know, that amount of Brazilian money now became $15,000.
Mm-hmm.
So that was always a problem, and people struggled. But they give fellowships. You know, I came with a federal fellowship
mm-hmm.
to do my PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they try to improve, and they're trying to keep people there also by giving fellowships now that do not allow you to do all your PhD abroad. You mm-hmm. do part of it, just like a couple of years, but you have to go back and defend your thesis in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
So they call that sandwich fellowships. And I guess that retains more people there, even though eventually people leave for a postdoc, and they might not go back anyways.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they have all the problems of a heterogeneous third world country. You know, you have some areas of Brazil that are extremely rich, other areas that are extremely poor.
Mm-hmm.
The money is somehow distributed. And, there are many problems
mm-hmm.
related to that,
mm-hmm.
inequalities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Last question about money, then, is I know you've got tenure now. But what does that mean if you're on 100% soft money?
Well,
what, if anything, does
right.
it mean?
Yeah, I can use as an example a colleague in the department that has tenure and run out of grants. And what happens first that your salary goes down quite a lot because your tenured salary is just a percentage of your salary.
So there is some salary guarantee once you reach
right.
tenure. Okay.
So your salary will go down if you lose your funds. You lose everyone in the lab because you cannot pay technicians or students. And there's a lot of pressure from the department chair. And in this particular case, the department chair either tries to find some kind of administrative job for this person to do, help with the website or do something. But the pressure is very high for this person to regain funding. Of course, the chairman will start to rethink the decision of supporting tenure for different people if you know, people lose their grants, because the idea of giving tenure is that's not going to happen. But it does happen. And in a way, it reduces a little bit anxiety, because you know you're not going to starve. But if you have any, you know, desire to keep a competitive research lab, mm-hmm. you know, if you lose your funds, it's the same as your group die, basically. Mm-hmm.
Well, some places will provide you with some bridge funds for a year or two until you can get refunded. Do they do that here?
Well, you see, that's the other problem of being in a clinical department. That kind of money is really not there.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the chairman could make a plea with the dean and try to find some special arrangement, but it's not very likely to succeed if the person is already, you know, not bringing indirect costs and things like that. So yeah, if you're in a more high power center that you know, the institution really believes that you can make a comeback, and they will have the money, that would be great. Yeah. But here in the clinical department, it's hard to see that happen.
Okay. Well, since we touched on paper writing, let's go there for a few minutes. You said you're rethinking how you do this, but it sounded like right now what you do is you have the students or the postdocs write the first draft.
Right. And then I go through it. Well, sometimes you have to basically redo the whole paper. So that's why I'm questioning if that's the best way. If they're really learning
mm-hmm.
just by, you know, you telling them, don't do it like this.
Mm-hmm.
So at least maybe the initial ones, it might help for them to see how to do it, because they really don't have much of an idea if someone ever, or if they wrote only one paper, it was, you know, struggle there, they don't even remember how they did it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like teaching, you know,
right.
What's the best way to teach?
Right. Well, if you said you've got a lot of foreign postdocs and some foreign students, but then you have the issue of the language again. I mean, some of the scholars I've talked to, when they came here as students, they didn't speak any English at all. So, can most of your students manage a first draft? Or?
Yeah, they do. I mean, I wouldn't have a fellow or a student that does not speak any English at all.
Yeah.
Mostly because I wouldn't be able to recognize the person's ability to do science and
right.
things like that. You know, that's a common problem of how to judge fellows from China, for example. It's hard for me to tell if someone is really good or not, just because of you know, the inability to communicate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, like as a student now, for example, I have an Indian girl speaks perfect English.
East Indian, not American Indian.
East Indian.
Okay.
I wish I had an American Indian. Could get a fellowship very easy. I have a Greek guy. Also speaks English very well. And I have another rotating student that's a Greek also. As fellows, I have one woman from Venezuela. She speaks English very well. I have a German guy who speaks English very well. And I have an Argentinian girl that speaks English very well.
So you have no American students at all?
No. Now I have a technician that's from Spain that speaks English very well.
Okay.
I had only one American student, postdoctoral fellow. That was actually a bad experience. It was the worst
one
I ever had.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. It was a very bright person.
Mm-hmm.
Probably one of the brightest I ever had. but he was just not committed enough for this kind of job. So, like, you know, between experiments, he would be reading novels. So his mind was not focused or concentrated on the project. So, you know, he stayed 4 years with me because of my inexperience and inability to fire people. I didn't fire him. But I think after a year and a half, I knew that he was not going to work out. And, you know, 4 years we have published a single paper. So that's pretty damaging to my program. And, you know, again, he was very good for certain things, but he was just not cut for this kind of job because his heart was not there. And research, you know, you have to dive into it. You cannot do it half-assed.
You can't wade in. You have to dive in. Yeah. Well, that brings us to another thing that PIs have to do, which is lab management. Something that you're totally unprepared for as a rule when you first get your lab. And I wanted to ask you, first of all, you mentioned yesterday that one of the things about Perotti was that he was well-liked. Is it important to be well-liked as a lab manager?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so. You remember yesterday that we were there in my floor and there was a woman screaming.
Yes.
She runs another lab in that floor.
Another PI.
Yeah.
She's a PI.
And I think she believes that by scaring people, productivity remains good or high. And so she keeps everybody on their toes. I don't think people in the lab particularly like her. They might be afraid of her. And also, I don't think that, you know, being afraid reflects respect either. So that's, you know, one way that I absolutely cannot run a lab. I mean, I think if people in the lab do not respect you, it's going to be hard to get things done and to have open conversations and things like that. And if you want to give them directions, you know, they have to respect you to follow your directions, otherwise they won't. But this, the way people run labs, I think it's made a personality trait and how you run life in general. So, you know, I try to be collegial with everybody in the lab. You know, with experience, I'm learning that maybe it's not a great idea to be too friendly. Maybe you should keep a little bit of a distance. Just because, you know, as the lab grows, inevitably you end up with preferences. And, you know, maybe how you treat some people over others, just because it's easier to talk to one than the others. And that's something that I try to avoid, at least how it is perceived in the lab. I try to make it as fair as possible. And, of course, if you socialize too much with people in the lab, that might lead to, you know, that might exacerbate this kind of difference. So that's something I used to do more in the beginning, and I think most PIs do a lot in the beginning, and then, you know, you do a little bit less, just maybe because you become more professional, and that's it's a more professional way to run the lab. So I think it is important to be liked. I think the only way that people work hard for you is if they work hard for themselves. So, you know, I try to keep them motivated as much as I can. I try to read what their goals are and try to help them define them and try to, you know, give them the opportunity to reach those goals. And that's how they work the best. But, you know, as an older professor told me, you can take a brute diamond or like a diamond on a rock and clean it and make a diamond out of it. But if you just take a rock, you can clean it as much as you want. It'll never be a diamond. So some people are cut for this kind of work. And then it becomes very pleasurable and easy to direct. And others, you're just going to be hitting your head against the wall for years and years. And that's one thing that is one of my weaknesses, I think, as a lab manager, is maybe not being more honest with people that maybe should not be doing this kind of job. And maybe I'll be even helping them by directing them to some different type of job. But I do have problems firing people mm-hmm. or letting people go. Mm-hmm. And that's related to, I don't know, it's also personality trait. Mm-hmm. And also the, you know, this thing of wanting to be liked, I think. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you feel sorry for people also, particularly people, foreigners, in many mm-hmm. cases. They will have to go back to their countries if they lose the job, if they are in an H-1 visa, for example. Mm-hmm. So that's an additional problem that is hard to deal with. Mm-hmm. But I can say here that the main problem of running a lab these days, for me, mm-hmm. is finding good personnel. Mm-hmm. You know, I spend a lot of time trying to hire people, and the percentage of people that I hire that are good is relatively small, even though I tried my best, and that makes it very difficult to hire. So I have a lot of positions that are open that I cannot fill just because I cannot find qualified people. Mm-hmm. And that's without questions, for me, the main problem I have in running a lab mm-hmm. nowadays.
So you could have a bigger lab now if you could yeah. find the people.
Yeah, I think I have at least 3 positions that they really? Could fill. Wow.
Is any of that because this is Miami as opposed to Boston? Or?
Well, partially, but as I said, I mean, I've talked to people in Yale and other places that are, you know, maybe they're not Harvard, but still very good,
yeah, yeah.
and they have the same problem. Hmm. So, yeah, being in Miami, it's probably even worse. Mm-hmm. The best people you can get here, first of all, foreigners, for sure. Mm-hmm. Second, if there is someone that's coming, like a physician coming to do a residence here, and the spouse happens to be a scientist that has to come to Miami, that's when you strike gold and get the best people that by some reason they have to be here mm-hmm. and they need a job. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not unhappy with people in the lab, but few of them really would excel and bring new things to the lab. Mm-hmm. They would do things that I'll tell them to do, mm-hmm. but rarely they will, you know, they will reach the lab with new ideas mm-hmm. and new techniques. Mm-hmm. But it does happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you said you've had a couple of role models. I mean, do you pattern your lab after those people that you?
Yeah, well, the couple were Parodi mm-hmm. and Sagalov. Mm-hmm. I wish I could be like them, mm-hmm. but I'm not. Mm-hmm. But that's what I aim for.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're both, you said they were both at the bench, and right. when we get done talking about all these things to do, I think there probably won't be any time to be at the bench.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, the administrative mm-hmm. load I have is pretty large, mm-hmm. and I don't know how they manage, so maybe that's what I have to learn.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about your administrative things, but let's just quickly finish up the lab. How involved are you? You know, some people are very hands-on mentors, and some people kind of let people do their own thing and just are open for questions. How involved are you in the day-to-day running of the experiments and the work in the lab?
Yeah, maybe I would like to be a lab and do it and let's just analyze the data, but I feel that I have to be a little bit more on top of that in terms of mm-hmm. how to perform the experiments and mm-hmm. things like that. Even though with the size of the lab I have now, it's not too big, but it's enough for me not to be able to do that mm-hmm. too much, at mm-hmm. least. So I have to trust them, but I still have to go through protocols to make sure that things were done right. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, with time, I become more distant from the protocols because you know there are either new protocols that I haven't done many times myself, and that becomes a problem. Mm-hmm. So it's harder for me to troubleshoot. And but that's the kind of PI I am. I like, you know, if particularly if something doesn't work, I would not tell the person just do it again. I'll try to go over the protocol mm-hmm. and the details mm-hmm. and see what happens mm-hmm. and see if there was some mistake that I can detect. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So my limitation to do that kind of, to be that kind of PI is really time now. So mm-hmm. now I cannot do as much as I would like mm-hmm. to. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm a little bit on, you know, kind of PI that I wouldn't say stays on, looking over the shoulder of the fellows, but maybe in between of letting mm-hmm. them just do whatever they want mm-hmm. and just checking the results mm-hmm. and being over their shoulders.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you mentioned administrative stuff, so let's go there. How much administrative work have you been sucked into?
Yeah. I mean, like this year, it's starting to get really bad. One thing is papers to review. Those come, you know, every week. Mm-hmm. But that's okay. That's not too much work.
Mm-hmm. For journals, you mean?
For journals. Mm-hmm. Second thing is people that ask you to contribute chapters to books. Mm-hmm. And that is becoming a problem, because that's not really a priority in my research. And sometimes friends ask you to do it, and it's hard for you to say no. That's something I should learn how to
say no.
Yeah. So, you know, like for example, I think April 15, I have to have a quite large chapter written that I haven't started, and I'm sure I will not have any time to start before April 15. I have to do my taxes before that. So that's a problem. And I have to start saying no to those things. Even though they are an opportunity to get junior people in the lab involved and get them to publish something that's important mm-hmm. to them. So, you know, I like when it's a short paper in an area that involves one of the junior people in the lab. Mm-hmm. Those are fun. Mm-hmm. But then the really bad ones are grant reviewing. Mm. And those are very painful to me because I'm not very efficient. It takes me a long time to review grants.
Are you on the study section?
Well, I'm in the Scientific Advisory Committee of the Muscular Dystrophy Association.
Oh, okay.
We meet twice a year. Mm-hmm. It's not too bad because the grants are not as long. They're only 8 pages instead of 20 mm-hmm. for NIH. Last month, I was invited to be an ad hoc in the mammalian genetics study section. So I had quite a few papers to read for that. And that took me a long time. Last week, the scientific review officer called me and asked me to be a regular member of the study section. That means meeting 3 times a year. And you know, reading a lot of grants. I was very anxious about receiving that call. I was hoping that she would not ask me to do that. And when she did, of course, we have that huge sense of debt with NIH that you have to do it. But at the same time, I was extremely hesitant because of, you know, how much time I have for research right now and how worse it's getting. So I talked to her a lot about it, and we discussed back and forth, but she still wants me to be there. So she said that, well, maybe we'll start 2002 so you can, you know, get rid of some of your other administrative responsibilities. That's just a dream. It's probably mm-hmm. just going to get worse, but I agree with it. Maybe I'll be able to skip some meetings, mm-hmm. not going 3 times a year. But I'll have to do it. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are many advantages in being in a study section. You learn a lot, you meet people. But at this point in my career, I don't think the price I pay for it is mm-hmm. worth it. Mm-hmm. would take me, you know, 3 weeks to review these grants. If it's three times a year, that's just going to chop a few months out of my year. Mm-hmm. Even though you learn a lot, you also might make some enemies being in study section. Mm-hmm. Particularly if you are, I would be the only mitochondrial genetics person there, so people pretty much will know if I'm reviewing their grants or not, if it's on mitochondrial genetics. That's not a major concern, but you know, that's mm-hmm. one of the negative things sure. in the study section, because it's public record who is there.
Sure.
Of course, you know, it's the whole study section that decides. I think I'm a very fair reviewer, maybe mm-hmm. in the general side, actually, and that sometimes a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not something I like to do. Mm-hmm. I really don't like to do that. Mm-hmm. Just because I'm very inefficient. So then I'm the steering committee for the graduate program in cell biology, cell and developmental biology. There are quite a few meetings, and you know, we decide who gets accepted mm-hmm. in the program or not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in several committees of students in different programs, graduate students. So we meet once a year to discuss their progress. And that's fine, that's part of the academic duties. I am in the Executive Promotions Committee of the university. That's for medical students that are recommended to be dismissed, that they can appeal to this committee. And that's once a month also.
That sounds emotionally intense.
Yeah, right. It's not too labor intensive, but it's quite mm-hmm. sad, actually, mm-hmm. to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're just, every single project you have to write an animal protocol.
Mm-hmm.
This animal protocol is going to expire. You have to renew it.
Mm-hmm.
Every year you have to write a report for one of the grants you have.
Mm-hmm.
So all these things add up in such a way that my days are filled with trying to, you know, fix those little things here
mm-hmm.
and there.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to squeeze time to talk to people in the lab. But, mm-hmm. You know, for me to actually do experiments, it's becoming harder and harder.
Mm-hmm.
Even though once in a while I try, just, you know, mm-hmm. when I have a little bit more time, I start something. But almost always I have to give it up, give to someone else to follow mm-hmm. it up, just because I can't, because I have to travel, I have to do this or that. Travels. I have cut a lot of my travels, mainly because of Julia, that demanded that I did so since we had Emily.
Mm-hmm.
I never traveled too much, but I cut even more. But I still go to meetings that I think are important. I enjoy going to meetings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get new ideas and you see what's happening, mm-hmm. and that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Let alone meetings like the Pew meetings, where on top of everything, you had entertainment
mm-hmm.
and very interesting environment
mm-hmm.
that's not only in your field.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how my days go. Some days I just don't know what I've done. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I just spend the whole day doing I don't know what. And also, sometimes you have colleagues that come to you to talk, to discuss mm-hmm. one thing or another. That can take a big bite of your day also.
Mm-hmm. Now, I noticed that you also you're involved in a couple of high school programs.
I was. I'm trying to, I mean, I have not volunteered to accept the summer students just because I cannot mentor them.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it would be fair to them.
Okay.
I had some mixed experience with a few I did.
Mm-hmm.
I had some that were quite nice and fulfilling. But I had a minority program once that really didn't work out very well, and that made me a little uneasy about these programs. There was a black kid from Georgia, I think, that they had some kind of fellowship that they spent the summer in Miami.
The state of Georgia.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the kid appeared the first day, we discussed the project, and then he'll just not show up at all.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, he had to write some kind of poster or thesis, and, you know, when he showed up, I was really pissed. And, but he wrote one of them. But I complained to the coordinator, and the coordinator went to talk to him, and, you know, he accused me of being a racist, and that's why I was so upset. And so that kind of thing really made me uneasy about participating in these programs.
Let me change the tape.